This is with Bob Avakian, the chairman of the Revolutionary Communist Party. And how in the world can you have a popular revolution in a country like the U.S.?
Now, I'm going to move into some questions that I think actually are more along things that I've run into as I went out, going out and talked to people. And recently, I had the experience of actually watching the film of your speech last year with a number of people. Sometimes with them, sometimes after they've seen it. And there's been a couple of fairly sharp questions that came up that I wanted to raise with you. One of them was, a person saw it and said that, and this is somebody, most of these people are from the middle strata. And this person in particular said that as he watched it, he kept thinking, this man is talking about a popular revolution. He's talking about a revolution that depends on people, the basic people in the streets, it depends on people in the middle class, it depends on the basic populace taking up this revolutionary ideology, taking up these revolutionary thoughts, or even taking up, you know, a position or things that would allow them to move into action against the system. And he was saying that the problem he finds with that is that for the most part, when he looks out at people, and in particular when he looks out at the basic population, but even the middle class, he finds people living a lifestyle that's sort of, as he put it, sex, drugs, and rock and roll. That's bling bling, that's, you know, we get paid, we get the whatever. And that the problem is not that just that they're doing that and that you would have some sort of, you know, even if he reduced it kind of crudely, he said, look, you know, even if you were able to go out there and wage a struggle around public opinion with these people, that they're living in a country inside a monster that has the biggest public opinion making machinery ever in the history of humanity. It has this huge, everywhere from the moment you wake up, you open your eyes, you're driving down the street, you can't look at a billboard, you can't, you know, there's nothing, it's just constant at you. And it reinforces all this, you know, backwardness and all this sort of self-serving kind of stuff among people. And that people, his opinion was that people would, how could you actually ever get into, you know, get that population into a revolutionary mode?
Well, I mean, there, on the one hand, there is truth. That is, they do have a very powerful, besides a very powerful military and a powerful economic base that underlies that, which is, once again, you know, grounded in just brutal exploitation around the world as well as here. But they have a powerful economy, they have a powerful military, and they do have a powerful machine for molding public opinion, for influencing popular culture, you know, shaping it, and so on and so forth. That's all true. And that those are obviously real obstacles to making a revolution, which anybody who's serious about this has to take into account and figure out how you're going to overcome that. On the other hand, let's look at the other side of the picture. They have this tremendous machinery of propaganda, public opinion, and yet, in the face of this move to go to war with Iraq, they had one of the most massive outpourings of opposition. Even though the media and the whole machinery of propaganda was mobilized behind this war and became, you know, cheerleaders and apologists for it and everything else. So clearly what you have there exhibited very sharply is the contradiction between reality and the distortion, the fundamental distortion of reality this propaganda machine constantly pumps out, became a very acute contradiction. These two things came very sharply into conflict. And a lot of people just saw through a lot of the propaganda, not all of it, and obviously not all the people, but literally tens of millions of people, and millions of them felt so, you know, incensed by what was happening that they felt the need to get into the streets or in other ways express themselves in opposition to it, despite this tremendous propaganda machinery and despite all the power that they have. And the same is true among, you know, that was largely, though, not only among the middle class. I mean, we did work and others did work among high school students, a lot of these, you know, proletarian high schools, and hundreds of students were coming out there as well as in more middle class areas. And, you know, this was a tremendous mass outpouring. So that's one thing, you know, where you can see that things do break through this grip they have on everything. And then, you know, you have things like what happened in L.A. in 92 or Cincinnati or even a place like Benton Harbor, Michigan recently that, you know, people are trying to get, you know, they're trying to get paid. They're trying to get the money. You know, that's the culture. I mean, it's pumped at them all the time. I mean, any kind of thing that comes, popular culture that comes forth that calls for something different than that and that challenges that gets marginalized to the degree they can. And, you know, sometimes it breaks through, you know, but then they try to marginalize and they just pump at people constantly, this this kind of a culture. You see it in the hip-hop culture now, where that's, you know, that whole influence has become dominant because that's what gets promoted, and that's where you can get paid, quote-unquote. You're not going to get paid talking about revolution. But you still see those voices, a lot of them now in spoken word, and some of them are in rap, you know, and they're fighting, even though they're not, you know, they're not predominating because of the, they don't, you know, because of who does control this and what their interests are and what they want out there. But you do see that despite all that, the oppression is there. Mao's point about where there's oppression, there will be resistance is borne out over and over again. And people, you know, get these explosions where thousands or even millions of people, or tens of thousands in any case, or hundreds of thousands, go into motion. Yes, you know, it's short-lived, it spends itself, but it shows the potential that people, and the fact that people want another life. And that a lot of the stuff that people get caught up in is real, yes, I won't say it's not real, but it's also superficial in another way. And it doesn't really, it isn't really where they live and where they feel. And I know this not just from abstraction, but from the work that we do among these masses with our, you know, with our party all the time, that it's very sharply contradictory. And interestingly enough, everyone who comes forward in response to our political work and says, you know, starts gravitating toward revolution and toward communism will say, well, I can get into this, but all the rest of the people out here are not going to go for this. Every one of them who comes forward says this, you know, and yet their people keep coming forward, you know. So right there you're seeing the contradiction being given expression, that there are all these pulls on other people, yet people do gravitate toward this. Not automatically or without a lot of work and struggle, but they do gravitate toward it because they really hate the life that they're living. And, you know, let's face it, here's this glaring contradiction. People are in the ghetto and they're in the barrio, or they're working in these poor, you know, these poorly paying jobs, you know, in the restaurants and hotels, and not just black and Latinos, but a lot of white people too. And they have all these illusions because it's pumped at them that what they ought to be doing is getting rich, but they're the farthest thing from rich. And most of them are always going to be the farthest thing from rich. And instead, they're brutally exploited when they can even work. And they're oppressed in a thousand ways and, you know, degraded and humiliated in a society. So this is, and this bursts forth. So yeah, people are into all the things that you're talking about. On the other hand, there is a fundamental reality to their lives that continually asserts itself, even through all that. And that's where you know, a vanguard force, a revolutionary party, comes in to work with people to bring that aspect of things forward and to struggle against the other thing and to enable people to see a way out of this. Because as long as you don't see a way out of it, you're going to fall back into all this other stuff. You try to get what you can get, or, you know, make your way in the world some way and try to, you know, let everybody know you're there in some form or other, which is a lot of what this stuff is about that goes on the street.
Well, before we get into the question of the vanguard, because that is something I wanted to get into, but there's also, I mean, you talk some about the basic people, about the proletarians, and you know, but what about, like, in terms of the middle classes too? I mean, it's sort of a, you know, there's a thing there where, you know, I mean, a lot of these people actually are satisfied with their life. I mean, and I've had the experience where some people have told me, look, even when they begin to know stuff, they've said to me at one point, they said, look, you know, I know some things. I know some things about how the world works, and yet I still live my life. I do what I do, and I find that what I know sometimes I feel is almost like a curse on me, because it's got me tied up in that. What would you say to that?
Well, there's the life again that people want to lead, and even to a significant degree are able to lead a lot of the time. And then there's the reality, once again, and what the system is about and what it drags them into, whether they want to or not. You know, I remember a story someone told me about during this build-up to the Iraq War. And they were, you know, they were in some sort of aerobics class with someone, and this one of the kind of people you're talking about, and they, you know, this person was expressing great anger. They said, look, we select these politicians to take care of all this stuff for us, you know, so they should be doing something to stop Bush from going to this war, especially the Democrats. But then this person finds themselves, same person, finds themselves out demonstrating because the Democrats are not doing anything to stop this war, and at a certain point they really feel that something has to be done, because they can see that this is, first of all, this war is terrible in itself, and second of all, it's part of a whole larger thing going on that's not going to be the end of it. And if you let that go on, then other things are just going to keep going in the same direction. It's going to go from bad to worse. So, yeah, a lot of people can, you know, in this society, especially given this role and its position in the world and the fact that it can, you know, plunder and accumulate wealth from the suffering of people all over the world. Yes, there are broad strata here who can live relatively well, viewed in more narrow terms, in other words, just purely economic terms, or even in terms of the culture they have access to and things like that. But there's this reality of this system that keeps doing these things, and there's a reason why people went into the streets against the Iraq War. It wasn't some sort of, you know, arbitrary thing or some incidental or trivial thing that just got up one day on a whim and decided to go oppose what the government's doing. You know, it's because these things do impact people in a lot of different ways, even right now when there's not a draft. You know, and it's still, I think it's becoming an open question whether they're going to reinstitute a draft. But even if they don't, or even now when they haven't, it still impacts people in a lot of ways. And people also can feel that there's something going on in the society where a lot of the assumptions they've had about how the society works with a constitution and elections and you vote and you select the leaders and the one who gets the votes gets to take office and all that sort of stuff and you get to speak your mind, or at least your door doesn't get kicked in if you're grumbling about the government and the privacy of your home. But some of these things are starting to come into question now, because this whole, what we call this juggernaut, this rolling monster of war and repression that they're carrying out, and what they're setting loose by doing that, and yes, a lot of crazy, you know, religious fanatics out there, not just in the White House, which is a real thing, but also out there, you know, in the world, you know, who have their own ideas about which God ought to be the one that is proclaimed and which kind of world we should have. You know, these things do rebound back on this society. They set in motion a whole bunch of stuff that we've only seen the beginning of, I think. And people can sense this. So they can't just sort of like retreat. I mean, I know, I can tell you stories beyond what you said. Like someone would tell me about, they were at a party one time talking to people there just about, you know, some cases of police brutality. And these were all sort of liberal-minded people. And finally one of them said, listen, I don't want to say that you're lying, but I just don't want to believe you. Because if I, this is exactly what the phenomenon you're talking about, if I believe that, then it's going to make my whole life be uncomfortable, basically. Mm-hmm. I'm not going to be able to go on living my life the way I am. Well, you know, for a while you can choose, you know, if you're in a certain position of relative privilege, and I certainly don't write these people off by any means, because you see them out there doing great things, too. But if you're in a position of relative privilege, you can do that for a while. But this system is doing what it's doing, and look what it's doing in the world, you know, and people may try to avoid that or make their peace with it, but it keeps impinging on your life in different ways. And, you know, people don't live just isolated unto themselves. They live in a larger, you know, context of a society and of social relations with people, and they do interact with other strata of people in the society, much as it's a segregated and, you know, and a stratified and hierarchical society and all that stuff. So these things are working in contradiction. All this is not going to automatically radicalize people or make them revolutionaries, but it does create a lot of turmoil in the society and people's thinking. And that's where, once again, the people who have a revolutionary understanding and, you know, a communist understanding come in terms of working with that and you carrying out what we call a process of unity, struggle, unity with people, uniting with them where they do see the need to oppose things that the system is doing, and struggling with them about where this all needs to go, and is there a better way that society and the world could be, and what's necessary to get there, and all those questions.
You know, it's interesting. One of the first things I did on the radio was a piece that it was called "If I Ruled the World," but it was the Nas song. But then I went around on the projects, and I asked people what the world would look like. What would they do if they ran the world? And then I went out in a park in Watts, and I found a homeless guy, and I asked him what he would do, what the world would look like if he ruled it. And then went up and talked to some immigrants, and then went to the West Side, talked to some people that worked in law offices, talked to doctors. And, you know, the thing that was really interesting is that, by and large, I mean, it was actually one thing, I think it kind of blew a lot of people away to hear the people that lived on the very bottom of society, this guy who was literally picking cans and bottles out of a trash can, stop and take his time and say, look, what I would do is I would make sure that everybody could eat, because I've noticed that there's a lot of very hungry people in the world, you know. And, you know, people, the broadness and largeness of mind among the proletariat, I think actually really, you know, blew a lot of people away. But also the thing that really got me is that I noticed that, you know, that so many people, including, you know, there was a commonality that existed between both the middle class people and the proletarians. Of no one said, I want to live large, I want to get for me. No one said, if I ruled the world, I'd make sure I'd be living in a mansion, I'd be driving this, or I'd be doing this or doing this. Everyone spoke outwardly about, like, you know, that they would go to other, they would take care of other people, that there would be this sort of you know, and there was a really good sentiment there that sort of, I think, shocked a lot of people when they heard that.
That's because people do live in a society, you know, even with all the individualism, I'm sure you could find people who'd say that, you know, like, I just want to get mine. But even a lot of those people would have more to say if you pursued it more deeply. But people do live in a society, and they have some sense of that, however much that's obscured and distorted, how society really works and what's at the foundation of it and what are the real dynamics of it. They still have some sense of that, you know, and that there is that socialization process in that positive sense.
Right. You know, they have a largeness of mind, too, that goes around this thing in a certain sense. I mean, not all of them, like you're saying, but it was interesting because there was a thing that was sort of, you know, I don't know, I mean, it was just so compelling because it was sort of, again, it was like there was a basic thing there where people could step up out of themselves and see this thing, you know.
And I think especially one of the key elements is you pose this question to people this way, which rarely happens. You know, most people don't even think that they should be thinking about things like that or that they have anything to say about that. And when it's posed to them in that way, then you get something different than what you might expect. I think that's the point you're making, or than what a lot of people would expect to hear. And, you know, I don't think you did it like Candid Camera, where they filmed 40 people and then found the one that was good.
Right.
I think, you probably gave an accurate representation. Yeah. Although, you know, you could find people putting forward those other things, but I think the thing you're talking about is very real and does reflect something very real. Mm-hmm. And that's the other thing about the people in the middle class, and I know this from my own experience, but not just my personal experience, but the broader experience of the 60s. As a revolutionary force does increasingly come from the base of society, that's going to change the terms of things also in a positive way. When it's a real revolutionary force that's guided by a far-seeing outlook on the whole world and a driving force that wants to not just, you know, change a few things around or put themselves in place of the other people who are messing over everybody else, but actually wants to uproot and eliminate exploitation and oppression altogether, and not just here but all over the world. When you begin to get a force that begins to assert itself on the political stage, so to speak, coming from there, that has a big impact on the rest of society. We've seen that in the 60s, and we will see it again. And it poses the questions differently. For example, right now we have this whole thing about the elections. Anything is better than Bush. You know, yeah, yes, Kerry's no good, but Bush, we got to, you know. And those are the only terms that a lot of people, especially in the middle class, but not only there, can see. They can't see beyond that framework. But if you, and it, as increasingly there is this force that's coming from the base that presents a whole different alternative to that, a much more radical one, a much more fundamental, the drive for a much more fundamental change, that's also going to impact the thinking of a lot of people who right now can't see any other alternative. You know, you talk to people and they say, well, I agree with you. Kerry's no good on this. Yes, he's just trying to be a better commander-in-chief than Bush. But what are we going to do? You know, people, you know, what are we going to do? And they don't see any other way other than hoping that somebody who's, in the present setup has some access to power could maybe be prevailed on to do something decent or at least not so terrible. But when you begin to get a movement among broad strata in society that challenges all that, challenges that whole framework, and as it begins to increasingly get this element of people coming from the base of society who say, we want a whole different world, that will have a big impact also. Not it won't automatically, once again, make everybody fall in line with that or say, yeah, let's go that way. But it's going to raise different questions and present a different way of looking at the options that there are, a different way of looking at what are we going to do.
Now, that's a discussion I got into with somebody, actually, right after the other discussion. Later that night, someone who said, well, yes, okay, I can see what you're saying, you know, generally, but here's the problem. I've known you guys for 30 years. And as far as taking out communism, taking out a communist project to people, communist beliefs, that we've always talked about, you've always talked about, you know, and he says that we've always talked about, you know, galvanizing a section of people around that. And he says, and for 30 years, that he looked at it the other day and he was thinking, well, that it hasn't, where is it? Where are the masses around this project? And for him, I mean, and this leads to, I think it leads to, in both cases, it led to different assessments of where, how you would go about making change. Like in the first case, when the guy was talking about it can't be a popular revolution because everybody's into the bling bling, he took a sort of spook, sat by the door approach to things and thought that 12 people should seize the key levers of power in the society and then change things. And this guy took a different approach. He said, you can't, you know, you haven't, I have yet to see people united around this project, or a significant hunk of people who have stepped out and united around this project. And so I think that really what you have to do is you have to look for coalitions where you can, make small dents. And as you gather more and more people up and you each are making your individual small dents, eventually you'll make one huge dent and knock things over. What would you say to that?
Well, there's a lot of questions bound up in that. I mean, going back to the 12 people, you know, conspiracy or whatever, the problem with that is, A, you couldn't do it. You're not going to be able to get wrench power with 12 people away from the people who have it now. They have a lot more than 12 people, and they have a lot going for them. And second of all, even if you couldn't do anything different with it than what, you know, than what they're doing. If you don't uproot the whole foundation of this, even if somehow you could magically find yourself in power, you would just have to do the same thing with the same system as what's being done by the people who run it now. And if you didn't have masses of people who were consciously striving for something else, you wouldn't even have any choice, even if you had the best intentions in the world, but to fall back on doing things the way they're done now. I mean, why that's so is a big, you know, long discussion, but I'm firmly convinced it's so, and there's a lot of experience that shows that it is so, where people get in and try to do good things and end up doing the same thing, and that's where you get a lot of this, oh, you know, leaders always sell out, because there is some, just like I said, just literal selling out. But usually it's not that. Usually it's people who have good intentions, but they don't really, their understanding is not profound enough and not comprehensive enough to know that you cannot just, you know, come in from the top and make some changes just because you have good intentions, or you have the interests of the poor at heart, or you have a desire for justice and so on and so forth, which many people, you know, out here do. People who, you know, try to reform the system in various ways, or to act as a force to bring pressure on the powers that be to get them to make some concessions in the direction of justice and, you know, alleviating the poverty and suffering of people and things like that. So that's, you know, that's what's wrong with that approach. It isn't an approach that could, A, actually lead you to get power. And if you did get it, you couldn't do anything good with it. That's the problem with that. Now, as far as the idea that you know, people won't come forward around this or haven't come forward around this, I think that the problem with that is it's a little bit of a linear view. It isn't. We haven't just been 30 years plugging away on the same, you know, exact continuum. There have been a lot of changes in the world. There was a whole upsurge, not just in this country, but in the world as a whole, going on in the 60s, a whole wave of anti-colonial struggles, you know, and the continuation of them, like in Vietnam, which was a, you know, monumental struggle that led to a defeat of U.S. imperialism and had major repercussions through the whole world. You had the China as a socialist country, which is carrying out a cultural revolution and, you know, figuring out how to keep the revolution from being reversed and make further transformations toward an eventual communist world. And that was, you know, a tremendous inspiration as well as a powerful force in the world itself. And in, you know, in this country, you had great changes that were being set loose by things that were rooted in economic and social changes, like things going on in the South with agriculture and a lot of black people being expelled off the land rather than being almost literally chained to it with debt and the KKK and all the rest of it, which gave rise to, you know, and then the Sputnik thing happened, and all of a sudden they wanted more people studying in the schools so the Soviet Union wouldn't be the only ones with satellites, and a lot of people came into the universities that were, you know, that wouldn't have been able to get in a generation before. And all these kind of things gave rise to, in combination and interaction, gave rise to a very radical, eventually to a very broadly based radical movement with a lot of people turning toward revolution and Marxism, communism, and so on and so forth, and Mao and all that sort of stuff. So that was a whole period that carried over, you know, the effects of that carried over really to the late 70s. But then, you know, the U.S. regrouped from its loss in Vietnam. It began to more directly confront the Soviet Union, which was also trying to seize on the advantages of the U.S. setbacks in the world. The Soviet Union itself had for a while been turned into a what we call a social imperialist country. It was still socialist in words before Gorbachev got there, and then they eventually ended up dropping even the facade. It was still socialist in words, but imperialist in essence and its inner essence and its role in the world. And things were shifting in a big way. And then, you know, there was a loss of China as a socialist country. The Cultural Revolution was defeated, and then socialism was reversed in China. And this had a tremendous impact throughout the world, including in the U.S., and things were changing inside the U.S. It wasn't this now you had a, you know, you did, it wasn't the generation, you know, say among black people, it wasn't the generation that was cut loose and hurled from the land into the urban ghettos, you know, or one or two generations. Now you had people who were living there for a while a lot of the industry was being pulled out, and there was a more polarization because concessions were made, more middle class positions were opened up for black people, but a lot of them moved out of the ghettos. And you had all these profound changes. Then you had a lot more immigrants coming into the country. So it isn't like we've been on, you know, many other changes that we could discuss. It isn't like we've been on one continuum hammering away, trying to get somewhere and never getting anywhere. We, you know, there was a tremendous movement that came forth out of the 60s. It's what gave rise to our party, not just what was happening here, but the whole international dimension I was referring to. But then we, you know, we had real setbacks. And when you have real setbacks like the loss of China, and you have shifting, you know, tectonic plates almost in the world where the contradictions are playing themselves out in a dramatically different way. With the, for example, in the 80s, the U.S. and the Soviet Union staring, you know, eyeball to eyeball, sort of, and the danger of nuclear war growing, and some of these other anti-colonial struggles in the Third World had sort of, you know, been reshaped within sort of the terms of this U.S.-Soviet confrontation. This has an effect on people. And we really, you know, I've referred to these, since you're taping for broadcast, I won't use the exact words I use, but I refer to these, I refer to the 80s and 90s, these terrible beep decades, you know. So I'll do it for you.
Thank you.
You know, and we're regrouping from that. And there's been a whole ideological offensive that's gone on in the world and in this country to say that communism is not just discredited, but is a disaster and leads to the, you know, the horrors of totalitarian tyranny and all the rest of that. Even, you know, somebody was telling me listening to some program on the radio, I don't know if it was NPR or what, and somebody was on there talking about how in China under Mao, the standard of living and life expectancy of the Chinese people went way down, which is the exact opposite of the truth. But the point the person who was telling the story was making was you can get up and say any old slander about, you know, socialism now, you know, the experience. I mean, that's exactly the opposite of the truth. The life expectancy in China during the time that Mao was, the, you know, leading China, went from 29 years to 65 years in a space of a couple of decades. And it's, you know, it's unprecedented, positive change. But people come and get on and just say the exact opposite of the truth, and nobody challenges it. So this obviously has its effect ideologically. And then if you look in the world, I know I'm going on about this, but it's a big question, you know, because I think it deserves a serious answer. I mean, I don't want to just dismiss this question. I think it's a very real, important question. But we've had things go on in the world where there's been a conscious effort. Well, there have been two things going on. One, economic changes in a lot of the Third World, for example, as well as economic changes within the U.S., but dramatically in the Third World, where tens of millions of peasants have been driven off the land by the workings of, you know, increased capitalist globalization, imperialist globalization. They can't even eke out a meager existence under oppressive conditions in the countryside, and they're hurled into the shanty towns around the cities in third world country from one part of the globe to another. And now we've gotten to the point where half the world's population is, or we're approaching the point, we'll soon be at it if we're not at it, where half the world's population lives in these urban areas. Well, this is a profound change from the time, say, they made the revolution in China, where in that country and in most of the third world, 80-90% of the people lived as peasants, exploited as peasants in the countryside. This presents new challenges to us, and the effect of this, where they're neither peasants in the old society, nor are they becoming integrated in the way, say, you know, even with all the horrors of it that happened in England, you know, centuries ago when they built up to the Industrial Revolution, where people became proletarians, and some of them were employed, but many of them were actually became proletarians, employed and exploited in capitalist in manufacturing and industry as it developed. And there's, you know, the certain outlook that goes along with that. What's happening in these third world countries is not that. It's that people are, you know, working in the informal economy, if they're working at all, you know, either illegal activity or often, you know, just selling things like literally like gum or, you know, similar items on the street or finding some way to eke out an existence. And a lot of this has left that, you know, their existence is precarious and they've been uprooted from their traditional situation but not integrated into a really a proletarian situation. So this leaves them vulnerable to things like a lot of religious fundamentalism, which is a big phenomenon in the, obviously we know about it in the Middle East, you know, in a lot of countries in that whole arc, and, you know, including places like Indonesia. But also in Latin America, for example, there's a tremendous growth of Pentecostal fundamentalism.
Mexico, and it was in Chiapas.
And it's all over Latin America because people are seeking an alternative to the Catholic Church, somewhat the way in which a number of black people here reject Christianity but take up Islam. They haven't really made a thorough radical rupture with all that. And the condition of these people who are uprooted from in their tens of millions in the third world and hurled into the shantytowns tends spontaneously and in the short run, in a more narrow sense, to make them gravitate towards some of this religious fundamentalism, even though it offers no way out for them. And actually this leads to, worse problems. So these are some of the economic factors. Then there's been, as I started to refer to, a whole conscious political strategy on the part of the imperialists going back several decades to wipe out secular and particularly communist opposition. Indonesia, once again, being the extreme example, where in the mid-60s they had a coup that brought Suharto in power, who remained in power for several decades, and they just wiped out one of the largest communist party, third largest communist party in the world, which was, it was sort of ripe for that because it was trying to pursue a strategy of somehow peacefully maneuvering its way into socialism. And they got wiped out by this coup that the CIA worked with Suharto to carry out. From between 500,000 to 1,000,000 people were slaughtered in a short period of time, with the rivers around Jakarta being clogged with the bodies of the people murdered by the military, with the CIA in there directing it ultimately. And you can go to other places where, the Middle East, Nasser, who was not a communist, but he was a more secular ruler. He was very popular, had a lot of influence, but when he was defeated by Israel with the U.S. imperialists behind him in the 60s, then, some of his, prestige went down. And, you could just go from country to country where the secular opposition has been crushed. And, in fact, these religious fundamentalists have been built up by the imperialists. I mean, Afghanistan, we all know, is an example of that, where they mobilized, organized, and armed and trained these fundamentalist forces to fight the Soviets in the 80s. But that's not the only place. They've also done the same thing in Palestine. They've moved to undermine the secular forces. Even the Christians, they've driven a lot of Christians out of Palestine, because the Christians in the particular area of Palestine tend to be more secular than a lot of the Islamic forces. And Israel's even worked to build up some of these Islamic fundamentalist forces in opposition to more secular forces. So if you look at all this in the world, and then there are the particular areas of the U.S., some of which I touched on, it's not surprising that we've suffered a lot of setbacks, and really what we're doing is rebounding from that. And this is a time when we're finding that a lot of people, for all the reasons we've been touching on, are very open to big questions and are themselves wrestling with big questions about the whole direction of the world, what kind of world they want to live in. There's that whole slogan that came out of the anti-capitalist globalization movement of another world is possible. A lot of people are wrestling with that, and we're finding a lot more, there's still a lot to overcome, but we're finding the more we go out boldly with communism, there's a lot more people, there are a lot more people ready to engage that. I won't say they're all jumping to embrace it, but a lot more people ready to engage that. So I see this is more a matter of a wave-like or spiral-like development that we've been through over the last several decades. And not a linear thing where we've been hammering our head, and just can't get anywhere. We've been thrown back, and now we're rebounding from that. And there's a real challenge to wrench something positive out of these, already acute and likely to become much more acute conditions that this whole juggernaut and the whole development of where the imperialist system is going is throwing the world into.
Okay, that was the second segment of a lengthy interview I had the opportunity and honor to do with Bob Avakian back a couple months ago. And we will be running that periodically over the next few months. And I'm actually really happy to tell people that these interviews, as well as there's also a speech that Bob Avakian made a few months ago on elections, democracy, and dictatorship, resistance, and revolution. And a lot of the shows that actually we've done on this Tuesday edition of Beneath the Surface will now be available to be downloaded from a website that actually is just starting up. And that's my website, which is www.redfuture.com. There you go. Redfuture.com. So you can't forget it. And you'll be able to download the segments of these interviews after they're aired, as well as read articles that I've written, other things that I have that I think are important for people to get to see. And you'll also get pictures of my dog, who when he was in the hood was known as Yogi the Rottweiler. And now that he's up there living with me, he's suddenly become Mr. Prissy Dog. And his name now is Yogiford P. Rottweiler Student. Okay? So Yogi, that's for you because I know you're listening to it today.